people got to that point quite accidentally. There was no formalized program or strategy in place to build customers. They might have lost as many as possible. They might have run some ads or done some selling efforts, but most of them were very inefficient. They probably allowed themselves and tolerated the minimal, not the maximum outcome from the effort. If you put formalized, proactive, strategic thinking in place and you started utilizing intelligent methods and techniques that had worked for other people, and you replaced those techniques with for the ones that you have been using that were ineffectual or unformalized or reactive, the odds are it wouldn't be very hard for somebody who got 1,000 customers in spite of themselves to improve their efficiency and add an extra 10% and get another 100 customers a year. Would you agree?
I'd agree.
Same thing with the unit of sale. Most people end up not directing their customer to the unit of purchase. They just allow the customer to pretty much evolve where they're going on their own, and the customer buys whatever level they want. That level, by the way, may not be in the best interest of the customer. The customer may be greatly benefited or far more benefited by acquiring a larger unit of a product or service, or by buying and acquiring at the time of purchase more support or complementary products or services that make the performance of the base product even greater. But a lot of companies are so fearful that if they try to intercede, the customer will buy nothing, and they're satisfied with the limited purchase they get, that they don't try to program the unit of sale. If you do understand that you have an obligation and an opportunity to help the customer get so much more out of the purchase transaction by giving them greater guidance, you will normally give them guidance to buy more or more combinations, and thus your average unit of sale will rise, and with it, your average unit of purchase per transaction, if you just formally program. Most people don't. So I'm saying if you just had the slightest amount of formalized, proactive, strategic effort, you'd probably increase unit of sale by 10% too. Would you accept that, Marty?
I'd accept that.
Okay. Same thing with the last tier in the quotient, the formula. Most people have no control formally. They take no control, over how often and what frequency people purchase and what they purchase when they come back. They're just tickled pink that anyone buys anything. When, in fact, if you take the attitude, a higher causal purpose attitude, that your goal is to get your customer the greatest outcome, have them be the greatest, most enhanced possible in the process, what results is that you lead your customer to coming back to you and buying more often and more unit of sale, not because it's in your best interest, but because the customer is normally gets a greater outcome for doing it, gets a certainty of not having interruption of result and service, gets greater benefit, and they will buy from you more often, particularly if you see yourself as having this purpose of bringing them all the greatest advantages you can, including other people's products or services. So I'm coming to the conclusion that if left to their own devices, they bought twice a year from you. Remember our example?
Right.
1,000 customers, $100 unit sale, two times a year. If you directed them in their best interest, not yours, you probably would get them to come back at least 10 times more frequently and probably a lot more. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
So I'm saying with a little bit of proactive strategic work, you could get your numbers from 1,000 to 1,100. You can get from customers, you can get your unit of sale from 100 to 110. You can get your repurchase from 2 to 2.2 times. If you only increased your numbers in each of those categories by 10%, you would not increase your bottom line by 10%. You would increase your bottom line by 33% because it becomes exponential. It starts growing by quantum leaps. It goes geometric instead of arithmetic. Likewise, if you really got serious and you start taking the kind of ideas and techniques I'm talking about, and you improved upon your ability in each category, not by 10%, but by like 25% here and 40% here and 30% here, and you identified 5 or 10 different ways you could improve each category instead of one, and each improvement was 10% and 20%, what happens is you produce massive quantum leaps. You go exponential. You shoot off the chart. The cumulative total starts being 400 and 500 and 2,000% increases. That's why I'm able to double and triple and quadruple and quintuple and 10 times grow companies in 18 months, because most companies demand so little out of their efforts. Does that explain it, Marty?
Yes. Okay. We are hoping people will listen several times to the Wizard's Edge so they can pick up the subtleties of what you're saying. Can you clue me in a real succinct way on how to maintain a possibility attitude rather than an impossibility attitude?
Sure. It's develop a philosophy of two things: external curiosity and a sense of discovery, an open-mindedness, an understanding that everything in the world is a combination of It's a new combination of old factors combined in new ways. And the only way you can do that is by looking at everything outside of your current situation, that the greatest opportunities for you are going to be outside, not within your business or your industry. Starting looking at everything everyone else is doing and asking yourself this question, what about that would apply directly to my business? What about that might apply directly to my business? If any implication of that would apply to my business, what would it be? How many things have they discovered that would have direct or indirect implication to my business? Developing an attitude of what I'll call an extrapolator, an interpreter, an importer, an exporter, a permutator. Looking at what somebody else has discovered and identifying what the driving principle behind it is, because a lot of people have accidentally discovered incredible breakthrough approaches they don't even know they're utilizing, and it only is evident when you start looking beneath the surface. Every time you go anywhere and do anything, have out-of-body experiences, ask yourself, what's making this work? How do they keep my attention? How do they get me to buy? How do they keep me loyal? What do they do that I don't do? What about their process have they developed consciously or unconsciously that is more distinctive than their competitors? And write it down. And then after you've written it down, ask yourself, what about that can I implement or apply or import or extrapolate to my enterprise or to something I'm going to do? And it's a simple thinking process, Marty.
All right, Jay, you have 4 minutes to highlight what people can expect in next month's The Wizard's Edge.
Let me tell you what we're starting to do. The greatest advantage, I think, of The Wizard's Edge is that it freeze frames for me at different points in my progression. I'm a constantly evolving person. I do training programs where I'll bring 200 or 300 or 500 successful business owners from totally unrelated activities together. I will direct them and lead them and extract from them insights into essences of what makes them uniquely successful, techniques they have realized about selling, about advertising, about negotiating, about motivating people, about managing, about marketing niches and business niches, about operational techniques that they don't even know they know, and I'll get people to expound upon it. I will make notes galore upon that, and I will use those notes in little filaments I will summarize on these calls. I do consultations. Yesterday I consulted with a publisher. Today I consulted with one of the foremost conceptualists in the world. Tomorrow I'm doing a retail chain. The week after that I'm doing distributors. Every time I do this, I've started a process where I'm going to discipline myself to sit down and summarize the core of what transpired, the core of that hour, the core of that 3 hours, the core of that day, the core of that 5 days, the core of that 86 hours, the core of what I learned or what I gifted, the core of what I observed, the core of the opportunity, the core of what makes something work, the core of what makes something or someone 10 times or 100 times more effective, the core of what something is discovered that you haven't. And I'm going to summarize all that and share it both philosophically, transactionally, illustratively, and then your job is going to be to marshal, to husband, to champion the rights and the position of the listener and to force me to define and apply and illustrate these implications in all kinds of real-life situations. I think we'll end up coming up with two or three model people, somebody running an enterprise, somebody wanting to start an enterprise, somebody running somebody else's enterprise, somebody basically in a profession. And we'll talk about applications of these concepts to all three or four scenarios so it's real and alive and dimensional. That's pretty much it.
All right. It's exciting to find that you're not resting on the great things you've done, but continue to grow. It's exciting to think about the successes that people already have in their own lives that you're going to help them find.
I think we'll also probably have guest interviews that I'll do. I think I can get a lot of my friends, Marty, to come on for 2 or 3 or 5 minutes and let me pick their minds clean in one short setting and show people the essence of what makes somebody a million-dollar producer or the leader in his field or get accomplished in 3 hours what most people can't get accomplished in 3 days.
Jay Abraham, you've been an inspiration to me. I'm so much smarter than I was when I began. I'm looking forward to the next month.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this, Marty. I look forward to the next month myself.
Talking with Jay Abraham, The Wizard's Edge. This is Marty Stacey. Thanks for listening. This is The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey. Jay, welcome again to The Wizard's Edge. I'm excited about what you're going to share today.
I'm excited to share it, Marty, and it's good talking to you again.
Let's talk a little bit about J. Abraham. It sounds kind of silly to say, was there a point when J. Abraham wasn't J. Abraham? But what I'm asking is, was there a time when you were not a marketing genius, and what made the change?
Sure there was. Marty, I started off very young in my life, and about five critical events have occurred over the last 25 years that progressively turned me into the person I am today on this telephone conversation with you. So why don't I start and tell you what they are, because it might have universal implications, applications, and illustrations to all the people listening to the tape.
Well, I think there's always a hope that we could maybe become like you.
Well, I think no one can become exactly someone else, but I think you could learn very easily to model or apply or adopt the same mindset principles and theory I do. Why don't I try to help share with you what occurred in my life very quickly, and it might be useful, okay?
Please.
First thing, I got started in life very young. I was 18 and married and had two children when I was 20, and I had the needs of somebody 40 when I was 18. Consequently, I learned very quickly the world doesn't care about your needs. All the world cares about is your ability to contribute value or profit or commerce or revenue or sales or customers. I quickly migrated from a number of dead-end jobs that were expense-side based, in other words, clerics, all kinds of internal office people, to external type situations where I generated income, where I created revenue. And I realized that when you can create revenue, you can name your own income, and everyone is delighted to share with you. So I became fixated with how many different ways other people had already discovered and perfected and incorporated in all kinds of other businesses that I didn't understand to create greater success, to generate greater sales, to produce more customers, to stimulate more revenue, and to accumulate more wealth. And I studied everybody in every field I could because I realized very young, perhaps naturally, that it is much easier to borrow proven success techniques and strategies from other people than it is to create them and perfect them and develop them yourself. It's faster. It's cheaper. There's a very much lower downside. There's a much higher upside. It's much more expedient. It doesn't take a lifetime. I also realized very quickly, because I would go in, I was a professional job transient. I went from all kinds of fields, from this field to that field to that field. Someday maybe we'll do a separate bonus tape that chronicles my life, because it'll take about 5 hours to go through each experience I had and the implication, and all of them are very valuable. But to shorten the whole process, what I realized was that most people spend their entire life in one field. As such, there's a dyad or a dichotomy that occurs, Marty. Part of them are extremely proficient and very, very expert at what their industry does, but all they know, plus or minus 10 or 20% differential, is how their industry operates. Their industry does not necessarily operate at optimal productivity, efficiency, profitability, sales, acuity. All most people in an industry do is that which they learn from somebody else in the industry, you learn it from somebody else in the industry, and no one gets better. There's a very old, trite story that's very appropriate. It's about a man who marries a woman he's in love with. They get married. They're very happy. They have Christmas gatherings for the family every year. They have pot roast. Every year when she's making the pot roast, she starts by cutting off both ends before she cooks it. The man is fascinated, and after about 3 years of doing that, he asks his wife, "Honey, why do you do that?" And she says, "Well, I learned it from my mother." Her mother is at the next year's family encounter, and the man asks his mother, he says, "Mom, mother-in-law, why does my wife do this?" And she says, "Because I learned it from my mom." And so incidentally, the great-grandmother is there, and he asks her, his grandmother, "Why do you do that?" And she says, "Because when I started out, we were so poor, we only had one pan, and it was too small for the roast. It became a habit. Not the most efficient, not the most strategic, not the most profitable, not the most intelligent use of the roast, but it became a habit. The way she did it, her daughter learned, followed, patterned. She did it. Her daughter patterned it after. A lot of people in an industry, all they know is how their mother's mother cut the roast. It's not the most intelligent way to do it, but that's all they know. I learned very quickly, Marty, that if you study 100 industries, you'll find 90 different ways to cook that roast. Maybe 80 of them are more effective, more productive. Many of them can be combined together to produce incredible improvement and geometric expansion. But most people who spend their whole life in one field don't ever learn that. I got the good fortune of going to 100, then 200, then 400 different industries directly doing consulting, working, doing joint ventures, advising, counseling. I was able to look at all the different ways people do things. I've been able to identify, define, summarize, condense, and extract the key essence, the morrow, the most primary organizing principle that drove the success process and the marketing success of hundreds of industries. And I've been able to summarize and incorporate combinations and hybrids which are unprecedented and give people in a certain industry a broad advantage because I open their eyes and let them borrow proven techniques from dozens or hundreds of other ones. So I learned that really quick. I learned if you do that, you can grow exponentially and geometrically, not arithmetically and not in a linear manner.
It's kind of amazing that the basis of growing is forgetting how you were doing things originally. I mean, we do all get kind of stuck in that rut.
The most wonderful sadness comes when you realize that all you can possibly do is what you know. But if you plug in to what 100 other people and 100 other industries know and have learned and have perfected, if you adopt the right mindset, and you and I were talking before we got on this line about mindset, and I think we talked about a philosophy that most people don't have. My philosophy is, what about that can I adopt to my situation? Most people say, I can't use that because my business is different, or we don't do things that way. I look at everything different. I look at everything everybody does that works, and I say, how can I directly apply that to the business I am either in or advising? How can I extrapolate if I can't directly apply it? What about that can I indirectly apply? If I could apply something about that, what would it be? What do I see in that person's success that is already evident in my client or in my business that I can modify or I can translate or I can transform over? And I keep asking how I can make something work directly or indirectly instead of defining why it won't work. I think it's a change in mindset. I'm trying to give you what Jay Abraham is all about. I realized long into the process that most people build their business on one platform. This is evident in that tape we sent everybody that Tony Robbins did the interview with me. I call it the diving board. If you look at your business, 90% of all the businesses I ever look at, Marty, their entire success is predicated on one pillar or one leg that 90% of their business comes from. It may be a retail location. It may be a selling organization. It may be advertising. It may be going to trade shows. I realized how delicate and precarious and dangerous and tentative that kind of a success basis is, and how much more stable, how much more leveraged, how much more geometric you can make your success if you expand the source of your revenue to multiple pillars, to 5 or 6 or 7 vehicles or sources or paths, and how easy it is to get your business far much more diversified. When you do that, how much more stable and expansive and profitable it can come by watching other people. And I had the good fortune in 10 or 12 of my early job situations to experiment, to take industries and businesses that were normally dependent on one basis of sales or customer generation and add 3 or 4 or 5 complementary ones that people in those industries had never entertained or contemplated, and saw businesses grow 10 times in a year, go from the also-rans to leaders in their field, and saw that every time I applied this philosophy, it worked better and better. That was a very critical distinction for me. The next thing I realized was that most people don't change their strategy. They just try to work harder. And unless, if you're not getting the result you want with a strategy that's not working, working that non-effective strategy harder and longer and more intensely only frustrates you at a higher level. I realize that the biggest distinction a company can get in changing their success pattern is to change their strategy. And then I looked at history and I saw that in history, Marty, the greatest achievements that are documented in business, in religion, in politics, in war or military, in people in the arts, in commerce, in entrepreneurialism, occurred when someone had the willingness to change radically the strategy. If you look at our government today, and I'm not drawing criticism or condoning our current president, but the reason Clinton is our president and Bush is no longer has nothing to do with Bush's competence, had nothing to do with the capital Bush had to put in his campaign. It had everything to do with the political campaign strategy Bush misadopted versus the correct one that Clinton adopted. Strategy is all important. Strategy is a critical element. Then I studied Deming and I studied Drucker, and I realized that in business there's three things. There's three things that are critical. Number one is marketing. Marketing is the only thing that makes money and innovation. I realized that most people don't understand innovation, that innovation from an entrepreneurial perspective has nothing to do with sophisticated equipment or technology. It has to do with the ability to bring an advantage, a greater benefit, a greater and more unique result to the customer. That if you've got great technology in your plant or in your business, but that technology doesn't manifest an advantage that the customer sees, you really aren't an innovator. And I redefined innovation. Then I did work with the people behind Deming's, the man who just died who brought technological might to Japan, and I realized a number of other things, that everything you do in a business is a process. As a process, it can be measured. As a process, that it can be baseline quantified. You could tell relatively accurately how that process performs on either profit or productivity or some kind of a denominated achievemental or result basis. Only when, if, and after you measure, identify, and quantify the performance of processes in your organization can you radically improve, because then you have a baseline to compare against. You know, if you have 10 salespeople and one salesperson averages 10 orders a week and one averages 1,000, you can figure out why the one averaging 1,000 does, what elements or principles or techniques within that person's conduct most attributes or manifests that superior result. Try to identify the universal premises and integrate them and teach them and incorporate them into everybody because you bring up your baseline. I realize you have to do that. I realize that your goal in life has got to be to optimize everything you do. And optimization from marketing means getting the best current and residual result from every dollar you spend, every action you employ, every contact you make, every distribution channel you have access to, every dollar I think you said you spend, and every piece of human capital you employ, meaning your advisors, your employees, your team people, your representatives, your customers. And that all sort of shake together to make me the person that I am, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes sense. How about, do you have a particular genius that you admire, someone you've learned from who's kind of a marketing great?
There are a number of people that impacted my thinking. Number one is I read and was very impacted by Napoleon Hill and his book, Think and Grow Rich. Think and Grow Rich is a very wonderful, although a little bit of a genteel written. The writing style is a little bit archaic, but the man interviewed 500 of the most successful men and women of the first half of the 20th century and deciphered and combined and identified the most universally prevalent success factors, and he summarized them in this wonderful little 300-page book. You can buy it for about $6 in paperback, and everyone should read it about 20 times. That was very impactful to me. A book by a man named Rosser Reeves called A Reality in Advertising was immensely impactful for me. It extolled the concept of unique selling proposition, that unique advantage that a company telegraphs to their customers that distinguishes them above all the other people that they hold, that they compete against. It's almost like positioning advantage. I read a book by a man named Claude Hopkins called Scientific Advertising, and then I read a book by him called My Life in Advertising. Claude Hopkins was the man who determined that that direct response advertising was the key element of life, and that salesmanship in print or salesmanship over the airways or salesmanship in letters was what advertising was all about. It was really selling one-on-one, but in a mass-disseminated manner. He delineated, identified, and understood that you have to demonstrate, you have to prove, you have to compare, you have to illustrate, you have to measure, you have to denominate why something is better. He pioneered reason why advertising, marketing, and rationales. I read David Ogilvy. He was extraordinarily impactful, and he's got a book, Confessions of an Advertising Man and Ogilvy on Advertising. They are profoundly and compellingly important to give you the tapestry, the background, the foundation upon which really effective marketing and advertising is predicated. They're wonderful, wonderful reads. I was very impacted by the work I did with Deming. It impacted me immensely because I never thought about optimization and its criticalness in the success of a business. I have had the good fortune of counseling probably 50 of the keyest training experts in management, in marketing, in selling, in influence, in persuasion. I could go on and on. I did work with Tony Robbins for a year and a half. I've done work with Tom Hopkins. I've had great teachers, great strategists come to my programs. I probably have such a broad influence, but I think more than the individuals, it's a philosophy. I am childlike in my insatiable sense of discovery. I believe you can learn massively by spending the time to be interested in everybody else you meet and learn about them, what they have consciously or unconsciously determined works for them, and what they are proficient at. Everybody is an expert at something. They are more adroit at that than you are. They understand it more intellectually and more intrinsically than you do. And if you spend the time, it doesn't take long if you become curious and learn the interviewing process. And I would say that the best interviewing process you could learn is to master and model Socrates, because he was the ultimate curious-based discoverer through interviewing, through interaction, through intellectual intercourse. He would basically engage people at all levels of the socioeconomic spectrum. He would interact with them. He would question. He would examine. He would observe. And that's what I learned to do, and it's a great attribute. Does that help?
Yes, 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 it does. Can we talk about one of your big strategies and have you elaborate? Talk about this risk reversal. You're saying that basically no matter what a person is involved in, it's pretty easy to double or triple the sales just using this one technique.
Well, I'll give you the whole basis, and I think it was evident on that Robbins tape, but I'll use a little example again. In the course of any business transaction, whether it's implicit or explicit, one side is always being asked to assume more or all of the risk from the other. If you recognize that, and you recognize that your biggest opportunity in the business process is to eliminate risk, to reduce the hurdle, to take the risk away, to reverse the risk and move it from the shoulders and the basis of the customer to your shoulders, and if you take the risk away from the transaction, there is far less, and I would arguably say there's no reason the customer wouldn't be compelled to at least sample the product in application, at least try the product out, at least tender a conditional-based order for a reasonable period of time. When I deal with risk reversal, I explain it as follows. Your job as a business owner is to find the way or as many ways as you can to get your product into the customer's hands, literally or figuratively, or get it being applied in the customer's business or in their home or in their lives. To the extent you can do it, you take all of the risk away in the transaction. Now, most people, when they sell a product, it's sold either implicitly or explicitly on some kind of a very abstract satisfaction guarantee basis anyhow. But that's very subtly stated, or if at all, if there is a problem, an ethical and integrity-based business owner will always make the problem right. They'll either adjust it, replace it, refund it, redo it. They'll do whatever has to be done anyhow, but they do it sort of abstractly. They don't really express or explain or incorporate that fact into their selling proposition, although it's something they do as a matter of course. My advice to every client that I ever work with, my advice to every indirect client, which is what I would consider everyone listening to this tape as being, is that the more you consciously and tangibly incorporate risk reversal up into the very uppermost premises of your selling proposition, you own the customer. Let me explain why. Today, more than ever before, Marty, products and services have evolved to the point of being viewed in the customer's eyes more as commodities than ever before. The world is striving to turn all of us into commodities. Our challenge, our goal, our purpose, if you have me advise you, is to refuse, to defy the tendency and the trend and not allow yourself to be turned into a commodity. Instead, ascribe a positioning that you are going to conduct your business as a proprietary. It's going to be incomparable. You're going to be positively distinctive. You're going to differentiate. You're going to stand out favorably and far more advantageously than any other business you compete against. The first basis, the first decision you should make is that your company will aggressively incorporate very definitive risk reversal into everything you do. You will guarantee the transaction to the extent you can, and we'll get in a minute to the different ways you can do that. You will make certain that every time you make an offer to a customer or a prospect for them to avail themselves of your product or service, that offer has incorporated in it a very high level of risk reversal. And risk reversal may be try the product for a finite period of time, and if it doesn't work, we will refund your money. It may be try the product for a finite period of time, and if it doesn't produce a very minimal performance outcome that you denominate, we will either give you back your money or we will adjust accordingly and give you a pro rata. It may be try the product for a finite period of time and it fails to produce a certain outcome. You may have a refund and we'll give you something else for your trouble. That's called a better than risk-free proposition. What I know is this. Companies that revere and incorporate risk reversal into a major and a fundamental leg of their selling premise normally report improvements and increases and expansions of 50 to 500% in their sales and corresponding profits. A quality product that performs appropriately when properly risk reversed will not produce a very high level of refund or adjustment, but owes it to its owner and owes it to the customer to be risk reversed because it makes it easier for the customer to understand and respect and avail themselves of the product. Most people, Marty, never really revere their product or their service or its results to the customer. Customer, it does not know what satisfaction looks like. Customers do not realize you're not selling a product to them. You are selling a result. The more you can define, the more you can denominate, the more you can quantify, the more you can measure, the more you can dimensionalize and make tangible what performance looks like in terms, in results, in expectation, the more comfort and confidence a customer has in making a favorable decision. If that customer knows that if he or she buys your product and it fails, provided they utilize it correctly and performance is a right you have to impose on the customer, on the transaction, if they perform properly in the use of that product or service and they avail themselves of it attentively and intelligently and correctly, if it fails to perform an expected upon minimum result for them, and result is the key, that they aren't going to be out a dime, that they aren't going to have made a mistake. People are terrified of making a mistake. They're terrified of not getting a good value. They're terrified of not getting the favorable result. The more you help them understand that, the better off you are. I encourage every client I counsel to aggressively and completely and continuously guarantee or risk reverse the transaction. There are many different ways to do it.
As you're talking about this too, if you could explain, for example, someone just starting a business, maybe turning a hobby into some spare income, maybe thinking about starting a business, how can a person approach this risk reversal process right from the very beginning?
Risk reversal has an infinite number of implications and applications. I'll take you giving me abstract scenarios, but let's say you're a person wanting to start a business. I can tell you, let's say you've decided that you're the product you're trying to sell yourself to somebody in a job.
Yeah, that was my next question.
I'll give you five or six illustrative examples, okay?
Good.
You're Marty Smith, and you need a new job. You're either out of work or you want a new job.
Okay.
Everyone else is going to the employer saying, tell me what's in the job for me. What are you going to give me in salary? What are you going to give me in benefits? What are you going to give me in growth potential? If you go to the employer and say, look, I only want to take this job if I can make a better contribution to you than anybody else who's possibly qualified. If I see that I can bring greater value, greater profit now and in the future, that I can grow dollar for dollar, hour for hour, space that I occupy, efforts that I expend, if I can add more current and future revenue, more efficiency, more productivity, more benefit and advantage to your business, I think I can. Judging from this job, I believe I can, but I don't know for sure, so I propose the following. Let me prove my worth on a conditional basis. Let's see how I do in the first 10 days, in the first 30 days, in the first 60, and you give benchmarks. If in the first 10 days I haven't already made a contribution and you don't already see me progressing at least twice as rapidly and integrating at least twice as smoothly as you thought, you have the right to terminate me. If at the end of 30 days I haven't already made a contribution that has made your company or saved your company at least my salary, you have the right to terminate me on the spot. If at the end of 60 days I've already you can't honestly say I've made you triple your investment in me, I'll leave if you want me to. And you always make it conditional. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But I would say most people don't look at work that way. I would guess most employers tend to even view their workers differently than that.
But if somebody said that to you, if you're vying against five people who are all equally qualified on paper and one who's equally qualified approaches it that way, which one would you be inclined to favor?
Well, not a difficult decision to make.
Okay, let's take a business. You want to sell me a product. That product is an expensive product. That product may be a product to only buy once in a lifetime or once in 5 years. I am apprehensive. I am not a little bit uncertain. I'm not sure that product will work out for me. If you say to me, Jay, look, let's figure out what you have to get out of that product in your blank, in your company, in your business, in your home, in your life, for that product to pay off for you, and we together ascribe a reasonable performance outcome. It can be dollars, it can be satisfaction, it can be reduction, it can be satisfaction, it can be protection. And we agree that if that fails to produce that in a finite amount of time, we don't want you to keep the product, and we give you an option. The option could be that you can return the product, or the option would be we'll adjust the cost by any shortfall. That's pretty reassuring, isn't it?
Yes, it is. How about the scenario when things are difficult to quantify? A lot of times when people are looking at a product they don't fully understand, they don't.
That's great. Then you do the following. First of all, it's incumbent on the business owner to go through the clinical process either on his own, by calling other customers and interviewing them, by working with the manufacturers, because there is data available. No one has ever realized the enormous and in valuable worth it has in incorporating it into quantification. If you don't have quantifiable results, you owe it to yourself to determine exactly what the impact, exactly what the result, exactly what the performance, exactly what the enhancement, exactly what the saving, exactly what the joy level is that your product or service produces for people. And that determination is possible by doing one of or a combination of the three things. Number one, interviewing all your old customers, leading them to help you measurably quantify by asking them questions where they come up with answers for you and saying, well, let's look at what your life is like now that you're using this product. Can you tell me that it's better? How much better? Can you tell me what the savings is? Can you tell me what the happiness is? And helping them produce the basis you use to guarantee. Conversely, you can call the manufacturer. You can ask its engineering standards. You can ask the quality of construction. You can ask what it should have as its performance life or its savings. You can ask them. You can go to other people who bought it from other people and get information like that. You can engineer yourself some kind of a test pilot, which can be part of a sales. You can say, I want you to buy it as a pilot. Here's our goal. Our goal is this product should save you 20% on efficiency over the next year. The base of that is our expectation that you perform on your part. Here's what expectation of performance means. We're willing to sell it to you on the basis that as long as you do your part and document it, if it fails to perform this minimum result, we'll adjust your purchase price by whatever the shortfall is up to 100%. Does that make sense?
Yes, makes great sense.
If not, if you don't have that, you can help determine, you can paint a picture for both sides by interviewing the customer and helping them see what performance should mean. Most people don't know what performance means. Most people have no picture for the definition or the meaning or the image or the result of what satisfaction is all about. If you are able to help people paint a picture, understand, dimensionalize what satisfaction means, you own them forever. For example, it's one thing for me to say, buy this product. I think it'll do well for you, Marty. It's another thing to say, buy this product. It'll be satisfactory, Marty. It's another thing for me to say, let's talk about what you should need, what satisfaction should mean to you if you buy this product. First of all, Marty, this product should give you and your family 24 hours protection, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, holidays not included. Number two, this product should always be there and dependable. You should know that if anything happens, if your electrical supply goes out, it'll always be performing. You should, and again, you go through a litany of all the things you should expect that you've never thought about. And you get the other side to say, yes, that is what I want, because they don't know what they want. Or you paint a picture of what they want, the value, the performance, the result, because keep in mind, you are selling a result. Nobody really is selling a product. The whole world of business owners have deluded themselves, Marty, to believe they are selling products and services. The marketplace is not buying products or services. They are buying the results. They are buying the benefits. They are buying the protections. They are buying the profitabilities. They are buying the enhancements that products and services produce. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and beside that, it seems like as the think begins to change, as the way you view the world gets in line with J. Abraham, it's like you get a certain verve, a certain excitement about interacting with your customer.
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest mistake I see in people is that most business owners fall in love with their company or their product instead of falling in love with their prospect or their customer.
Okay.
If you fall in love with your customer, you always ask yourself, how much more benefit, how much more advantage, how much more contribution can I make to them instead of how much better can I sell the product? If you focus yourself on how many ways you can make your company or your product or your service benefit the customer, how many ways that benefit can be dimensionalized, how many ways you can take risk and fear away from the customer, you are advantaged. You have advantage over everybody you ever compete against, Marty. It's axiomatic. And people are scared to say, well, if I guarantee that, but I'm giving another purchase, by the way, another premise that I forgot. Some products, it's so costly that people are afraid to guarantee the whole purchase. Like if you're a realtor, you say, well, I can't afford to guarantee a $500,000 home sale. I mean, if it's bad, I can't buy it back. And I say, yes, but you can guarantee every process up to and following the transaction for, and we've done this with a lot of realtors, just as an illustrative example for those people who are poo-pooing the guarantee philosophy. For realtors, we say to them, go to your customers and say the following. I will not allow you to sign with me and have me represent you until you've talked to at least 20 people that I have dealt with, listing and selling and purchasing. And you have to ask them privately whether they agree that their outcome was more benefited by having me represent them than anybody else, that they came out $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 ahead, that they got their transaction done 1, 2, 3 months faster, that they got more money, that they got less grief, and that they got into a house they didn't think they could afford, and that I got them a greater advantage on financing. If they can't say yes to all those questions, I don't think you should feel comfortable using me. If they do, it should be axiomatic to you that if I've done it for 10 out of 10, I'll probably do it to you. You should even talk to somebody who I'm not working with who didn't go with me and ask them those questions and ask them if they got that out of the person they used. Number two, if you do decide to deal with me, all I can promise is that I will deal with you as if you were my own family. I will worry about your transaction. I will protect you. I will never be spineless or equivocating. I will always advise you and lead you and authoritatively tell you what I believe and why I believe it. I will never forsake you. I will never patronize you. I will warrant to you that I'll always give you my best reason, professional advice, and sometimes it will be not to buy something that would make me money or not to sell something that would make me money because it's not in your best interest, and I'll tell you a better strategy and why. If you follow my advice and when you make the transaction, if you're buying a house, for example, and you move into that house and you can't honestly say that you are happy at the end of 1 year, I will sell the house for you for no commission, and I will pay half your cost to move out. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very, very true.
So you can use risk reversal 100%, or you can use it on a modified, but you have to use it if you want distinction, and you have to want distinction if you want advantage. And if you don't want advantage, you're destined to be a rudderless commodity whose business is going to regress and going to die.
Can you generate a business letter, some kind of letter that would entail this, that would help any of us get started? And I don't know if you want to gear it to maybe the person who wants a career path, someone who's starting a business.
Well, I'd rather give you a model with components. I mean, I can freeform right now talk to you about, I mean, maybe a letter is the wrong word because some people will use it as a letter. Some people use it as a model script for their salespeople in the field. Some of them use it for incorporation into advertising. Some people will use it for the people that they have in their offices who handle orders or who meet people on their selling floor or behind counters. Some of them will use it in telephone selling situations. But I'll give you some key fundamentals.
Please, please.
Okay. The first thing is you take the position that I have a result. I know my product or my service or my company can produce for you that you've never even recognized you should want for yourself. My wish for you is that you allow yourself the greater result that you can get out of this product or service, and that I know that I can produce that for you. I know it with such confidence that I'm willing to guarantee you get that outcome or a superior one, or I won't consider the purchase transaction binding. I know it. I can do it because I have these results from all the other people who have worked for it. For example, you share with them other people and what their outcome was. I think this is what and why you should want this outcome. And you go with, you go over a projected, what I call future pacing of take them on a journey to what it will be like when they have this product, your product or your service in place, and they are availing themselves of it, and they are reaping the result, key is result, the benefit, what it will be like. Then you give them examples, and you measure it. Then you say, here's the only way I will sell this product to you. As long as you guarantee me, or you, it's not guarantee, as long as you warrant to me or agree that you will apply the product or the service properly and continuously as it was intended, and we'll go through that when we sell it or when we deliver it or when we formalize it, I am only too happy to guarantee you a minimal outcome of either joy or satisfaction, and describe what satisfaction is, or tangible results or improvement or savings or productivity or whatever. If you fail to get that, I don't expect you to have paid that full price. I will adjust the price by a pro rata up to blank, or I will take the product back, or I will replace it, or I will send people out to adjust it or redo it until you get that outcome. In short, if I can't produce a superior result that gives you advantage that we both agree upon is a fair and reasonable expectation for you to desire, expect, and depend upon for spending the money or making the investment, I don't want the transaction. I mean, I'm sort of, that's a general one, but that's a good model, Marty.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds good as a general outline.
just as I'm thinking here about the, well, basically revolutionary way you look at turning yourself...
And evolutionary.
Okay.
You've got to keep evolving. You've got to evolve to the point of being sensitive. See, I'm stepping on you, but I want to make an interrupted question.
Please.
When I work one-on-one with a client, the client isn't my real client. I am advocating, I am championing, I am solely focused on their customer and what will advantage the customer, what will compel the customer, what will benefit the customer, what will enrich the customer. I think everybody's got to realize, whether you like it or not, your challenge, your goal, your purpose is to become a value creator for customers. And since I'm doing it vicariously for people through this tape, they've got to decide to do it themselves. The customer doesn't care about your needs. I don't know if we talked about this on the last tape or not, did we?
Not very extensively. Go ahead and talk about that just briefly.
Well, when I'm doing a training program and I've got 200 people in the room and they paid me $5,000 or $25,000 and I do three different levels of program, I say to them, look, you guys don't care why I'm in this room. You don't care if I feel sick. You don't care if I'm going to lose my house if I don't come up with a $200,000 payment. You don't care about any reason why I'm here. All you care about is I sure as heck better give you a multiple of your $5,000 or $25,000 investment in value and information and advantage and ideas and benefits, or you're going to be pretty darn upset. If you realize that no one, unfortunately, cares about you, they care, they're consumed totally about themselves. The people listening to this tape, they're on pins and needles. They sure as heck better get value every month from this tape from me, or they're going to be very displeased. Understand, you are a human being who's consumed with your own self-interest. That is good. It's not bad. That's the way it is and the way it should be. When you understand that the people you deal with, your customers and prospects, are no different. All they are obsessed and consumed about is what's in it for them. They feel violated. They want to make sure they get full advantage, but they don't understand what advantage means because no one's ever helped them draw a picture of it. When you learn how to draw a picture of what advantage is, what benefit is, what result is, what satisfaction is, what advantage really means, you can own them because none of your competitors do it.
So the wizard's edge, in essence, is evolving to the place in your own life and a mentality that you understand how that works.
Well, that you subordinate your own self-interest and become totally redirected into what will give, what will render the greatest contribution, the greatest value, the greatest satisfaction, the greatest benefit, the greatest fulfillment to the customer. Not only financially or tangibly, but emotionally, because the greatest achievements and the greatest accomplishments and the greatest fulfillments people get are not tangible. They are usually emotional. If you think in your life, the greatest moments in your life, the greatest times, it probably wasn't financially denominated. Maybe it's when you had the birth of your first child, or your wife said yes, she'd marry you, or your husband asked you, or your kid graduated, or you bought your first house, but it wasn't really the money issue. It was the pride issue. It was the acknowledgement of having worth. It was a lot of things, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Turn the tape over now as we conclude the program on Side 2. Jay Abraham, the marketing wizard, give us the wizard's edge, the answer to some very practical and very crucial problems that you've solved for some of your clients.
Well, I'm going to give you a couple of broadly recurring problems, questions, and opportunities that I'm pitted with when I do private consultations, when I do big training programs, and when I do other kind of interactive advisory sessions with people, because it's pretty universal. Probably the first biggest problem people have is, how can I make my advertising work better? Now, a lot of people listening to this are not even advertising, but you're going to like the answer, because I tell most people that advertising is the least cost-effective, the most promiscuous, the most subordinated marketing factor most people should be thinking about. And the way to make your advertising work better is not to advertise, and that shocks them. And I did an interview with USA Today on that, and they didn't print that because I did it with the Los Angeles Times, and they didn't print it because it was contradictory to what they stood for. But my whole take on people is they've got their priorities wrong. When business owners are struggling to get a business going or growing, when they are when they're downtrending on sales, they think advertising is the key element. It's normally the least significant. What you got to do is regroup. Ask yourself and identify first, where is your business coming from? And when you analyze that, normally the easier way to grow a business is not to improve your advertising, but to improve your utilization of your existing velocity in motion. And by that I mean this. If you have people coming into your business, figuratively or literally, customers or prospects, by converting more prospects to customers, by increasing the unit of sale you do with each customer, by increasing the frequency and the predictability of those customers coming back, by increasing the quantity of products or services those customers buy, by increasing the sphere of influence those customers can bring to you, i.e. referrals, you can so much more broadly and immediately and cost-effectively grow and impact your sales and profits that advertising is subordinate. Does that make sense, Marty?
Yes, it does. Can you amplify that just a little more so it's not quite so theoretical?
Yeah, sure. People come to me and they say, wow, I desperately need to make my advertising work better because it's not working and my business isn't doing well. I say, well, why don't you not do that right now, because you're basically wasting most of your money. When you advertise, unless you advertise in a very industry-specific publication, most advertising is wasteful because you're paying a premium for 100% of a readership or a listenership or a viewership, when in fact only a fraction of those people are really prime prospects. 100% of your customers, active and inactive, and almost 100% of the prospects who have come to you are prime people. You've already gone through the arduous and expensive process of identifying them, weaning them over to you, introducing yourself to them. It's much easier, it's much more immediate, it's much more cost-effective, to resell those people or sell those people than not. So the first thing I have people do is go through their existing business operation. Make sure they know exactly who their customers are by name, by address, by phone number, by buying influence, if it's a company who buys from you, by product or service interest, and find ways to go back to them and sell them directly different or more of or broader or more superior quantities or versions of the product or service they have already bought, because your customers are historically and predictably your best customer basis for new sales. And I have people do that first. Then I have them go to their prospects they didn't convert and find out why they didn't convert them, and go back to them and repropose better articulations of offers to get them started, including risk reversal, including smaller purchases, including all kinds of things. If they can't do that, I have them take their prospects they didn't sell or their inactive customers that they are no longer selling, and I have them work joint ventures with their direct competitors who sometimes have products or services that are more appropriate. I made a customer one time a small fortune by showing them that they could take all their prospects who never bought, who they couldn't sell, and making a joint venture with their competitors, work a deal where on a 50-50 basis on profit, make more money from the people they didn't sell than the ones they did, because the reason they didn't sell them had nothing to do with those prospects being interested in the generic product or service. It had everything to do with my customers not being able to sell them, not having a product or service that fit their market, not having a pricing or terms that were appropriate, having products that were either too or not complex or sophisticated enough, or having salespeople that weren't compatible enough, but that people didn't inquire, people didn't come in, people didn't call, people didn't write, people didn't send for things because they were not interested. They sent for them because they had an abiding interest. They didn't buy because my customers, and the people listening to this, you don't get customers, you don't get repeat customers because you restrict, you make it difficult, you limit, you inhibit the customer's ability to transact business with you. You got to find out ways you can you can open the spigots, you can make easy, you can unlimit their ability. reality. You can stop restricting it, and that goes along with the way you communicate, the risk you take away, the way you denominate. But again, people who think that advertising is a problem don't really understand their problem. The problem is they haven't prioritized the best way to build business. The best way to build business is first and foremost to go to the customers you're already doing business with and go to them and find more and better ways they can buy more often, and more aspects of your product. The second best way is to go to prospects. Prospects can be people who inquired and didn't buy. They can be people who bought and aren't buying now, and revitalize and resuscitate the purchasing relationship by giving them ways to make dealing with you easier than not, by eliminating the barrier of entry, by lowering the hurdle, by taking away the risk. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Now let me ask you about when you do use advertising, how do you channel that? How do you target that correctly so that it's not just an exercise in expenses?
Well, there's a very simple formula that almost nobody does. First and foremost, most nobody has a good headline or a headline in their advertising. And the headline in the ad can be many things. If it's a print ad, it's the opening bold block phrase that appears above the message. Most people don't even have a headline. If they have a headline, it's the wrong headline. They don't realize that a headline is 80 or 90% of the impact of the ad. It is the ad for the ad. It tells and denominates and telegraphs and projects the biggest, most self-saving result the reader or the prospect can expect to get from reading the rest of the body copy and from availing himself or herself or their business of the product or service. You have to make your headline denominate the biggest self-serving result you can possibly project. Okay, I'm going to give you a litany I'll give you a real quick stream of consciousness reference of what I find most lacking in most headlines, and I'm going to refer to a great master because I got some notes that I use when I do my $5,000 training programs, and I'll refer to that as a basis here. First of all, when I look at almost every ad, every sales letter, every commercial script, I realize that most people don't have what we'll call the you attitude.
All right.
And the you attitude is focusing everything on you, the customer, your benefit, your advantage, your desires, as opposed to mine. And I'm going to start by taking apart. There was an ad that we received that was replete with the you attitude. It came from Hume Publishing recently. It was a mailing they did. There was an excellent illustration of the you attitude in headlines. And hopefully by studying these, it will help the listeners of this tape better grasp the concept. All of these were headlines and sub-headlines were contained in one mailing piece. And when you're getting it, the reader immediately identifies with these messages because they are filled with his benefits to the reader. The copy never talks about who we, the company, are or what our product does. Each and every possible benefit is written with the reader's self-interest in mind. Okay? So let me go through a few of the examples from this piece, and then I'll get into other headlines, okay?
All right.
Okay. It's all about investing to make money, and it was about becoming a millionaire slowly. It was a very interesting investment course. And so one of them started by saying, if you, and I'm going to inflect the word you where it was in these are all headlines, if you seriously desire to become a millionaire. The next one is, how to uncover up to $2,500 in additional funds each year for investing money you don't even realize you have. The next headline was, see how exciting it can be to put a big dream in your life, a big goal to become a millionaire. The next one was, why you really can achieve this goal, especially with the help of this simple plan. The next one was, the first lesson is yours free, plus special bonus for prompt response. Seven great ways you can invest in the 90s. The next headline, the first principle you must understand to become rich. The next headline, black and white proof that you can become a millionaire. The next headline, I dare you to be great. I dare you to set your sights on becoming a millionaire. The next headline, you will learn how to grow wealthy from those who've actually done it. The next headline, you will learn at your own pace. The next headline, you will discover secrets of building wealth no one ever shared with you before. The next headline, you will get yourself organized to build wealth. The next headline, you will know the right ways to build your fortune in stocks. I could go on, but I think you get the idea, don't you, Marty? Now, let's talk about headlines.
All right, go ahead.
I'll use as a reference a brilliant, brilliant expert named Eugene Schwartz, who wrote a book on headlines. Basically, I'm Abrahamizing a few of them and explaining them. Here's basically a series of ways to make your headlines great headlines, and I've got to make a point. The headline is the opening phrase for the ad. It's the opening basis of any sales letter. It's the opening basis of any advertising, including commercials on radio or television. It's the opening phrase you utter in person or by telephone when you sell and present a proposition to anybody else. So there are universal implications to what I'm about to do. Okay?
Go ahead.
On headlines. Number one, measure the size of the claim. I'm going to give you examples from actual ads that were successful, okay?
Okay.
The headline that measured the size said, 17,000 blooms from a single plant. The next technique is measure the speed of the claim. The headline illustrating it, in 2 seconds, bare aspirin begins to dissolve in your glass. Number three, compare the claim. Example, 6 times whiter washes. Number one, two, three, four. Metaphorize the claim. Example, melts away ugly fat. The next one, sensitize the claim by making the prospect feel, smell, touch, or hear it. Example, tastes like you just picked it. The next one, demonstrate the claim by showing a prime example. Example given, at 60 miles an hour, the loudest noise in the Rolls-Royce is the electric clock. Next one, dramatize the claim or its result. Example, they laughed when I sat down at the piano, dash, dash, but when I started to play, dot, dot, dot. Next, state the claim as a paradox. Example, how a bald-headed barber saved my hair. The next one, remove limitations from the claim. Example, shrinks hemorrhoids without surgery. Next one, associate the claim with values or people with whom the prospect wishes to be identified. Example, 9 out of our 10 decorators use Wonder Weave carpets for long life at low cost.
Can you Abrahamize some of those down to maybe a personal level or maybe to a letter level? Right? Because they're all great headlines, but they are headlines.
Well, but what I'm saying is, okay, let's just start. If you're talking to somebody, let's go back. If you're talking to somebody, instead of an ad, if you said, look, Marty, I know you're an avid gardener. If you're going to grow roses, wouldn't you like to grow roses that produce 5 times the buds and 4 times the average size and 40% deeper color and hue and are 4 times hardier and larger than the average rose? If you can do it for no more time, no more effort, and for 20% less cost?
All right.
Does that make sense?
All right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. How about a service?
Okay. All right. Well, give me an example of the service. Just create one.
Okay. Let's say a podiatrist.
Okay. All right. That's more of a professional service, but that's okay. Yeah, I'll go through. I'm just going through the same headlines. Basically, if I said, blessed relief 24 hours a day from the pain and the anguish of corns, bunions, ingrown toes or toenails, that would be pretty direct, wouldn't it?
All right.
The crux of learning my mindset and my methods is directly connected with your ability to extrapolate, to interpret, to apply, to import or export ideas and applications to your situation Everything you hear, you must learn to ask, what about that can I apply directly or indirectly? And then you've got to try. You cannot say, well, that's all about flowers. It won't work for me, and that's an ad, and I don't do ads. And you got to say, how exactly or inexactly can I take the essence of that or the literalness of that or the illustration of that and extrapolate, implement, apply, interpret, incorporate, import that into what I am doing or the way I do something? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But the reason so few people look for things is because looking is kind of hard. It's the finding that's fun. How?
It isn't hard. It's exciting. It's an attitude. It's a wrong attitude. If you look and say that, look, every ad I read, every time I ever am solicited by anybody in the mail or on the phone or in person, every time I ever go out and buy anything, anytime I'm at a restaurant and someone uses influence and persuasion, I can learn to employ a direct or an indirect application of that and incorporate it into my business and give my business advantage. Everybody out there is giving me leverage because I'm learning from everybody else who's already, through trial and error or consciously or unconsciously, experimented and directly or stumbled across improved ways to compel people to take action, and I can basically use all of those to my advantage. I think it's exhilarating, Marty.
All right, so a change in attitude.
Change in the strategy. That's right, the way you look at it. Instead of being intimidated, being exhilarated. If you think from this day forward, Marty, from the moment you turn this tape off and you get out of your car or you get out of your office or out of your house or wherever you're sitting listening to it or standing, from that moment forward, the rest of your life, everybody you come in contact that does anything well is your teacher, and you're leveraging. If I took 20 years to learn my sales presentation or my letter or my whatever, and you see me do that or you receive it, and you can take the essence of it and identify it and incorporate it instantly or whatever element or elements are superior to what you're doing, and you can either replace what you're doing or add to what you're doing, and you do that 10 times a day,
wow.
Look at the leverage you get. I think it's exhilarating, and you're the only one that sees it. You're going to put on this incredible pair of infinitely broad three-dimensional glasses, and everybody from now on is freely teaching you. People are sharing with you unintentionally everything they learn, the keyest elements. You're being, every time you experience something that impels or compels or induces or influences you to want something, to desire something, to believe something, to buy something, to respond to something, you're disciplining and redirecting your thinking. So you say, I'm going to take that essence and apply it directly or indirectly to me, and it's going to make you grow at such a rapid, continuous, progressive level. It's the most ultimate experience. You're on the adventure of a lifetime.
Wow. That's terrific.
That's how I would look at it.
And the tuition is free, and the time is already committed, and you're just reaping this tremendous benefit.
But anybody who understands the upside and leverage should get excited, because what you're doing every day, every hour, every minute, every time a salesman or woman calls on you, realize they've tried their presentation. If they're still in business and they've been in business, they've probably tried 100 different ways to do it. What they're giving you is the best way they've found of trying 100 ways. If you can pay attention not just to what they're saying, but the implications of it and the construction of it and the composition, the methodology and the components of what they're doing, and you can make mental or written notes, and then you can say, what about that works for me? You're learning something that may have taken them 10 years. When you get a sales letter, most companies have tried 5 or 6 other sales letters, or 500. They've mailed and spent hundreds of dollars or thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions to find the one that's the most effective they're mailing to you. For you to be able to get that, instead of throwing away, say, what can I use about that in my own efforts, in my own selling efforts, in my own direct mail? Pretty exciting to contemplate.
That is. How about something that you've learned in just last little while? Maybe one or two ideas that you've learned from other people.
Well, I think that the best idea, I'll give you a real quick 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, maybe a 14-point thought process. And here's what I've learned. Almost everybody's got hidden assets and overlooked opportunities in their current business, and that they owe it to themselves to do something about it. Almost everyone can make the selling efforts that they take at least 20 to 200% more effective just by testing and experimenting and improving their sales ability, their risk reversal, their ability to present a better premise or positioning, and to lead the person to action and show the person what it will be like after they avail themselves of the product or service. I've learned that almost everybody has got a $25,000 to $1 million cash windfall within their business just by identifying what they know about their existing customer base, what their buying habits and their specific areas of interest are, and making direct offers to different segments of the list of larger, broader, more continuous versions of the product or service that those people can avail themselves of.
Let me ask for the person who's trying to be an entrepreneur and doesn't exactly have that. Is there another way he or she can find that within his situation?
What's the that you're defining? Because I'm not sure what that means.
Okay, the extra revenue, the unexploited customer.